Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island, proud supporter of live music and driven to think big about beer since 1988. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago, Illinois. Think big about beer.
I am on a lonely road and I am traveling, 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 looking for something. What can it be?
You're listening to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot. He's Jim DeRogatis. And that's a little bit of the song All I Want by Joni Mitchell, the lead-off track from her 1971 album Blue. Even 47 years later, people are still talking about this record and influenced and moved by it, regarded as one of the greatest of all time, certainly one of Joni's greatest works. Unflinching honesty, poetic lyrics, those were elements in this record that inspired a range of artists. Tori Amos, Liz Phair, even Prince was singing Joni Mitchell's praises for years. Today, we're going to take a deep dive into Blue and discuss why it's a classic album and dissect some of the tracks, and we're later going to share our opinions on it.
Absolutely, Greg. Who is Joni Mitchell? Born 1943, Roberta Joan Anderson in rural Alberta, Canada. Was a creative kid, apparently, right from the start. Would later go on to art school. But it was not an easy upbringing. She contracted polio early on. It was that time, bedridden, when she learned how to play guitar and began to sing. She got pregnant when she was a poor folk singer, struggling to make her name in Toronto in the mid-60s, had a daughter that she gave up for adoption. It was only years later, in the mid-90s, when a tabloid outed that she'd had this child. They since reconciled. But what a thing to be exposed to the public. A series of toxic, sometimes chaotic, certainly romantic relationships that I think got undue attention often. And all through it, Joni is writing countless iconic songs in the folk pop tradition. From Both Sides Now.
I've looked at clouds from both sides now, from up and down, and still somehow.
To Big Yellow Taxi.
Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
Today we're going to zero in on what many people believe to be Mitchell's greatest album, Blue. We're going to start our conversation by speaking with David Yaffe, author of the biography Reckless Daughter, a portrait of Joni Mitchell. That book was released in 2017 and details Joni's life, career, and music. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
For the young'uns out there, David, who don't know, can you give us the capsule biography, this young woman from Canada, and how she set the world on fire, or started to, in the music world?
It's interesting because usually when someone is a writer, when someone is a musician, they have idols that they want to emulate. And that didn't happen with Joni, not really. She had people that she knew how to imitate, but she didn't idolize them. So she's an unusual case that she's a great artist who didn't have somebody that she tried to emulate first.
Do you think this is part of growing up sort of remotely?
Well, that's part of it. She did grow up in this place that Margaret Atwood described as a blank space on global culture.
Yeah.
I mean, it was very isolated. It was very remote. Her family didn't have money. She didn't travel, really. So she just had that open sky in her creativity. She didn't have exposure to much. But she said she didn't grow up playing air guitar in the mirror or anything like that. She thought of herself as a visual artist, but really on a practical level, she thought that she probably ended up working in the fashion industry and that this folk revival was a fad and it would go on for a few years and it would die out and then she would do something else.
He has heard her off to starboard in the breaking and the breathing of the water weeds while she was busy being free.
Something that set her off from the other children was when she got polio at age 10 and she was taken to this polio colony. And her father never visited. Her mother visited once with a mask on. 6 months go by, she gets her legs back. And suddenly she's no longer the first one picked for teams. You know, and she had thought of herself as an athlete. She kind of defined herself through that, you know, and suddenly her sense of identity was gone. And so she started to turn inward and she started to define herself as an artist, as a visual artist. the kid who could draw the best doghouse, that kind of thing. Mm. And all she really needed was just to go off in nature somewhere, go off in the woods, and be creative. And that was how she got through. And then she goes to art school. She doesn't have a scholarship. And so nobody's really treating her like she's special.
So this arty kid, it seems like almost a little daydreamy as a teenager, figures out how to play guitar and basically invents an entire new style with the open tunings. By the end of her career, or as her career is winding down. This incredible method of approaching this instrument with an immaculate voice to go with it, and then this incredible songwriting acumen on top of it, all apparently self-taught, right? I mean, what
completely.
Was...
Completely, and she didn't know that would happen.
And David, we mentioned it earlier, but she's in college at art school. She gets pregnant during her sophomore year. She gives the baby up for adoption. This affected her very deeply. Where is she mentally at this point, and how do you think it was reflected in her music?
That's right. And she's living in a very, very cheap rooming house. She's completely broke. I mean, she has the money that she's making from folk gigs, but then when she starts to show too much, she can't perform anymore. And so she's really, you know, like her neighbors are taking pity on her and giving her fruit and stuff like that. I mean, she's really, really broke. So she gives birth February 19th, 1965. It's one of those things where, like, it's a situation where someone is pent up and can't say what she's thinking and can't say what she's feeling and has to keep a big, big secret about the source of it all. And then it comes out in a sublimated way through these beautiful songs.
Child with a child pretending, weary of lies you are sending. So you sign all the papers in the family name. You're sad and you're sorry, but you're not ashamed. A little grief.
And so because she was hiding this shame, and because she had this grief of giving up her daughter, the first song that she ever writes is on the train. She's with the guy who got her pregnant, this guy named Brad McMath, who took off soon after. They go on this 14-hour train ride to Toronto. And so she hadn't written any songs. She was just doing traditional folk songs. She was singing the songs that Joan Baez and Judy Collins were singing. She was singing songs out of the child ballad book. You know, Nancy Whiskey.
Whiskey, whiskey, Nancy Whiskey. Whiskey, whiskey, Nancy.
So she's on the train, and she starts to write this beautiful song. It's called Day After Day. She never records it. But it, you can hear it on YouTube. There's a demo of it.
Day after day, miles and miles of railroad track, night after night, harmon of the wheel.
Those kind of triadic folk chords that she got away from pretty quickly. It's about a damsel in distress who's waiting for a hero on a horse to come and save her. But she doesn't think that's going to happen, so that's the sadness of the song. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful song, and it's amazing. It's her first try, and she didn't think it was good enough to record, probably because it was too derivative, but very impressive for a first try.
Mm-hmm.
And, and the second song she writes becomes a minor hit on the country charts, and that song is Urge for Going.
Yeah,
which was
recorded second
by...
song.
That's her second song.
When the sun turns traitor cold and all the trees are shivering in a naked row, I get the urge for going, but I never seem to go.
So let's fast forward a bit. Joni goes on to record her first three albums by 1970. She's won a Grammy, garnered a large fan base, found commercial success, and this is right before she starts recording her fourth album, the record we're focusing on today, Blue. How did she handle this, since stardom and being famous wasn't really something she was looking for?
You go into it, you hope that you make it, and then there's no exit strategy. That's right. Isn't that always the case?
Right.
Right.
In Joni's case, because her work was so personal, she didn't have a way of creating the kind of barrier that probably you would need to have a healthy attitude toward it. I mean, when you think about, for example, the way Dylan was in 66, when he was so vulnerable, and you could see why he couldn't handle it and why he had to go off the road for 8 years. And then you see him after that, and you see that he kind of creates this persona that distances himself a little bit and allows him to function in a way, because he's not, there's a barrier between him and the audience. And I feel like Joni never really got that. Joni was always herself.
Now me, I play for fortunes and those velvet curtain calls.
So that work is intimate in every way. And so I think that when she felt vulnerable, it brought on something that she thought of as, like, she said, well, people in the West might call it a nervous breakdown, but I thought of it more as a shamanistic breakthrough. A shamanistic breakthrough. That's how she thought of it. And so she wanted to, you know, she announced her retirement in 1970, and she went to live in a cave in Greece.
Mm-hmm. Was it literally a cave? Did you get to the bottom of that? In
yes.
Greece, is she literally living in a rock hole? Mm.
Yes, yes. She was with this girl named Joellen, and she was living. Yeah, it was a fashionable place to do it. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of hippies were hanging out there. and then, of course, it was there that this girl, Joellen Lapidus, designed a dulcimer for her that she ended up recording with on Blue. She did Case of You on that dulcimer, right?
Yeah, right.
California also. That's also. She was engaged to Graham Nash. They were living together in Laurel Canyon in that house on Lookout Mountain, and which I've been in the house. It's a pretty modest house for rock stars to live in. It looked like a place that two graduate students would be sharing, really. She was making money, but I just don't think she knew what that was or how to deal with it or anything. Because she was just thinking about, you know, being creative and doing what she wanted and dropping acid when she wanted to and whatever.
Well, there's that fascinating interview she gives to Cameron Crowe about that, that point in her life. I came to a turning point, the terrible opportunity people are given in their lives, the day they discover to the tips of their toes that they're a-holes. What is she talking about?
She said that she could look at people and read into them and read into their souls. And it was so overwhelming to her that she would be at the supermarket and she would see somebody's soul and she would cry. And that the very thing that she was doing in Blue, which terrified some people and which besotted others, was that she was doing that with her listeners.
Right, because that quote is in relation to her being where she's at when she's writing and recording Blue.
Yes, but I think when you hear, for example, like the title track of Blue... So beautifully distilled about this melancholy that she's describing, and the fact that she's using a color to describe it is so important, because she used synesthesia. She thought like a visual artist.
Yeah.
You know, her parents, her father was colorblind. Her mother was also, she thought, colorblind, whereas she was color acute. So part of it was responding to her parents and saying, I can see things that you can't see. You didn't know what you were doing when you were raising me because you couldn't see. I can see it, right? And so when she says blue, it means a lot. It's an emotion. It's a color. It's tied to the blues. You know, she loves Kind of Blue. That was probably in the mix there.
Well, it was very poetic writing. She wasn't she wasn't being super literal. And I think that's part of the charm of the record, is that people want to read all this stuff into it, but there's also a universal quality to it that allows mm-hmm. anybody to see themselves in it if they want to.
I mean, that's true, and I call it the Joni Mitchell effect because she's hiding in plain sight.
We're talking with David Yaffe, author of Reckless Daughter, A Portrait of Joni Mitchell. You know, this very 1970 habit of the music world in particular, but life in general, of framing a woman's talents and success and career with the men in her life. So as a biographer, you're telling the story of making Blue, writing Blue, recording mm-hmm. Blue, and you can't ignore, you know, there's the Graham Nash relationship has unraveled, the time in Crete, living in the cave in Greece, mm-hmm. there's a relationship with a waiter, and then James Taylor's in the wings and this romance.
There was a Peace Corps activist who was a cook named Carrie Raddatz. Carrie's the song, and then Leonard Cohen is in there too, because A Case of You is really about Leonard Cohen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to the extent that any song is about anybody.
Well, I think it was also, I think just for additional context here, I mean, just to add to that, is that the way the record was perceived around that time, Rolling Stone did a whole section about who Joni Mitchell had slept with around the time
right.
that this record came out, which to right. me kind of like, okay, that is a typical male response
right.
to a record by a woman to frame it in terms of who she'd slept with. As
especially
opposed
with
to,
that generation,
yeah.
that generation of men. And that, I guess what I would say is that her experiences are hers just in the same way that Bob Dylan's experiences are his, or that Leonard Cohen's experiences are his, or John Lennon's, or whoever else you want to think of as being in the peer group of Joni Mitchell, Paul Simon. They write about their life. They write about their loves. They write about their sex life. They write about what they do. And it's their prerogative to do it as artists, and nobody's going to question it. And just as nobody should question it if you're Joni Mitchell or anybody else. Right? Everybody's life is up for grabs when you're an artist. So she's an artist. But I also think that the experiences are less important than the fact that they happen to Joni Mitchell, and that Joni Mitchell then has this way of articulating it. She has this way of interpreting it. She has this way of expressing her reaction to things that happen to her. And so it's not very remarkable to, you know, have a love life, have breakups. Yes, some of those people that she was intimate with were famous, but that's pretty typical too if you think about it, because people, they often hook up with people that they're
right.
in the same field with.
What you're saying though, if you remove all of that context of who it was specifically that she may or may not have been writing about, it's still a masterpiece.
It's a masterpiece, but in fact, I think that if you're to take it for what it should be, then it is about intimacy. I mean, that's part of the story. It is
yeah.
about relationships. I think it's artificial to remove it from its intimate content, because that's the point.
I want to talk to you. I want to shampoo you. I want to renew you again and again. Applause, applause. Life is a pause when I think of your kisses. My mind seesaws.
You know, David, you used the word intimacy, and I think it's a fascinating one. And my rock critic hero, Lester Bangs, said of Blue that it's a record that's too intimate. I almost feel like a voyeur as a man listening to Blue. It makes me uncomfortable. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. No, I think she wanted, because she was feeling uncomfortable herself. And so I think that's... That's the effect that she wanted. I mean, I think she wanted to confront people, although she did so in dulcet tones, but she did. I mean, the last time I saw Richard is a confrontation,
mm-hmm.
for sure. You know, all romantics meet the same fate someday. That is meant to make people uncomfortable, although, of course, it's with this, you know, beautiful voice and these beautiful climbing piano chords and so on.
I'm gonna blow this damn candle out. I don't want nobody coming over to my table. I've got nothing to talk to anybody about. All good dreamers pass this way someday. Hiding behind bottles in dark cafes.
It's a combination of the lyric writing, the melody writing, the chords, the rhythms, with these truths, these intimate and often uncomfortable truths. To be fair about this record, by the way, and I think I said this in the book, that Blue was maybe a 60% moping record and a 40% party record.
Yeah.
Because some of those songs are actually joyous. And when people talk about blue, they think about all this grim stuff. But you have Carrie, which is a playful song, and it's a song you can dance to.
Oh, Carrie, get out your cage.
Carrie, get out your cage.
California is kind of hopeful,
California,
too.
California. California is kind of sweet.
California, coming home. I'm going to see the folks I dig. I'll even kiss a sunset pig. California, I'm coming home.
It's interesting because, like, you know, she wasn't like Janis Joplin. I mean, Janis Joplin had this kind of raw reality that she was taking it to. And it was something that, you know, led to later Patti Smith and whoever else you want to say, Lucinda Williams, Liz Phair. I mean, a certain kind of aggressive quality that Joni herself would kind of have in a later incarnation of her life. But on Blue, everything is so euphonious. Even when she's talking about the darkest thing, I mean, Blue is this beautiful, beautiful song. Like, while it's about losing yourself and to something that could be, you know, the heroin that James Taylor was hooked on. It could be just going to the darkest, darkest place of trying to hide in this cloud of melancholy.
Well, there's so many sinking, now you gotta keep thinking you can make it through these waves. Acid, booze, and ass, needles, guns, and grass, lots of laughs.
The album, especially if you go to the bluest songs on Blue, like Blue, like the last time I saw Richard, like A Case of You, it's just, I mean, this is a word that's used about it a lot, but it's just so honest. But what's remarkable is that a lot of things can be honest. Something can be honest and also not be good, right?
Sure.
Blue is unflinchingly honest, and it's a thing of beauty.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, and maybe that makes people uncomfortable.
It's confusing to men because I think the emotions that she's talking about, a lot of guys really are uncomfortable dealing with those. Let's forget not just Joni Mitchell, but just talking to women in this way in general for a lot of men is very difficult. And I know a lot of women who really relate to this record because she's expressing what they would like to say or are feeling but can't articulate necessarily.
Yes,
so it's an interesting split the way – it's interesting that a lot of male critics reviewed this record at the time. But since then, we've seen a lot of women chiming in on the record, you know, as their voices become more heard in our media. And I think they're the ones that are really championing this record in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, listening to it in 2018 or listening to it just – you know, anytime in the new millennium, or listening to it in the 90s,
yeah,
it's a different experience than listening to it in 1971. And also about like why it wasn't that well received when it came out. It was not an instant big seller when it came out. It took a long time to become her biggest seller, and a lot of that was like in the 90s.
Yeah,
really. And when the whole sensibility changed, and when you could be a different kind of a woman, I think like Patti Smith like really shook a lot of people up and sort of moved the needle on all the ways that you could express yourself as a woman.
We've been talking with David Yaffe, author of the biography Reckless Daughter, A Portrait of Joni Mitchell. David, thanks for coming on Sound Opinions.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for such a stimulating conversation.
After a short break, we'll continue our discussion of Joni Mitchell's Blue by talking to music critic Lindsay Zolads about blue's impact. Later, we'll share some of our favorite tracks from that record. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
We don't.